Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. On this week's show, I'm joined by Canadian Sasquatch researcher Cameron Young to discuss some cases from the province of Alberta and beyond. Cameron tells us how he became interested in the subject of cryptozoology, some of the researchers he's spoken with, and the support they've offered him. We dive into a few cases from the provinces of Canada, some of Cameron's investigations, the cases he finds the most compelling, and much more. It was a big thank you for Cameron for sharing his knowledge and investigations with us, as diving into Canadian Sasquatch reports is something I've been wanting to get hold of for quite a while. Thanks, Cameron, for joining me this week. And as always, before we get there, don't forget you can support the show on Patreon for $4 a month by clicking on the link in the show notes or going to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. A big thank you to my most recent patrons, Samuel, Jacob, and Brian. Welcome to the team. And thank you for your support. Mysteries and Monsters is also across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. With Christmas coming up, don't forget you can now get hold of Mysteries and Monsters merchandise by visiting mysteriesandmonsters.com and clicking the tabs on the top of the page for mugs, stickers, t-shirts, and more. As always, artwork for the show is by Dean Bestel. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, let's head to the province of Alberta in Canada to join Cameron Young on the hunt for Sasquatch. On this week's show, we return to the subject of cryptozoology, and of course one of my favourite subjects, Sasquatch. I'm joined by Canadian researcher Cameron Young to discuss his work and influences, as well as some intriguing cases from Alberta and beyond. Cameron, I'm delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you for having me, Paul. How are you?
I'm very well. How's yourself?
Pretty good. Just watching the snow fly here, because of course in Canada we get that all the time, right? So, no, it's actually our second day of snowfall. Yesterday was our first, and which is actually usually a good sign, because we usually get snow here before Halloween. So for it to start snowing on the 15th of November, that's late for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've got family in Canada, so I'm very aware of snowfalls and precipitation out there, Cameron.
Right.
So it's something I've learned a lot more than I ever thought I would if you'd have said this to me 40 years ago, how I would know about
right. The
average Canadian snowfall. But there we have it, my friend. So thank you firstly for joining me. As we were saying off air, I've been wanting to dive into some Canadian research and reports and researchers for quite a while. So I'm delighted to track you down, Cameron. Your reputation has begun to precede you, as we jokingly refer to off air.
Right.
I'm always interested because often for many people, depending on their age, you can kind of gauge what their sort of gateway into the subject of Sasquatch and cryptozoology was. So for you, Cameron, what was the touch paper that lit your enthusiasm for this subject, or maybe even gave you a sleepless night or two as a child?
Well, to be honest, my interest in Sasquatch and Sasquatch research started in the fall of 1997. I was only 7 years old. I just turned seven in July of that year. And we were having supper, and I don't quite 100% how we got on the topic, but I think we were talking about, you know, how my dad used to live in BC or whatever, and he brought up the name Bigfoot, Sasquatch. And I'm like, well, what the heck is that? You know, I'm 7 years old. I don't know what that is. And he says it's this half man, half ant creature that lives in British Columbia in the mountains. And so I'm like, uh-huh. So I started asking him questions about it. And it actually happened to be, you know, in school. I was just in grade one. So, you know, I was only in grade one. So keep this in mind. I've started doing this when I was in grade one, 7 years old. And so it, you know, I think I'm definitely probably be one of the youngest starters out there. So it happened to be library day at school the next day. So every day or every once a day each week, we had a library day as a class. So my dad said, well, when you go to the library tomorrow, you go ask the librarian and see if they have any books on Sasquatch or Bigfoot. So, of course, like a good guy that I do what I'm told, right? So I go up and ask the librarian, do you have any? And I can barely see over the counter. I'm a pretty short kid. And I asked the librarian if they had any books on Sasquatch or Bigfoot. Sure enough, they did. And I brought home a good stack of them. And I showed my dad, and then I got reading them, and it captivated me. And then I kept asking him questions, you know, pestering him. And, you know, not that my dad wasn't a researcher in this. He just lived in BC, you know, for a short period of time, I think in the summer of 1981. And cause he was originally from Ontario, he moved to Alberta. Then he moved a little bit in BC for work. Cause back then the oil business was really booming in Alberta in the late '70s, early '80s.
Hmm.
And so anyway, so he kind of answered all he could, and the years kind of went on, and I kept reading, and, you know, the internet was just kind of coming on, and, you know, so I didn't have a computer internet access, but my uncle did at his place, and I started, you know, researching Bigfoot there. And my mom was a school teacher, and she, of course, they had internet and computer, because I lived out in the acreage in the country. We had no internet, we had no computer. So she taught in the city at Edmonton at a high school. So I would go there on days off, because my dad worked out of town as an oil rig worker, so I had to go with her. So I started looking up Bigfoot on that, and started going down the rabbit hole with that. And then one night, you know, I'd say within a year later, my dad and I were watching, I believe, Simpsons reruns, and they had a commercial for this old Kodak camera, and the Kodak camera commercial featured the Patterson film. And that's the first time I saw it, because my dad and I were just talking about it. And then all of a sudden, I'm upstairs to get something, and my dad yelled, hey, it's on TV, it's on TV. So I run down the stairs, boom, 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 you know, and I saw it, and my jaw just dropped. Like, that was the first time I've ever seen it. Like, I heard my dad talk about it, I read about it, and I never saw the famous picture or anything like that. And I saw it, my jaw just dropped. I couldn't believe what I was looking at. And that, boom, instantly lit the dynamite under my butt. And I was hooked. And then we used to have a channel called CTV, and on it was a documentary called Sasquatch Odyssey. And I learned about now, you know, most people in the Sasquatch research world call them the four horsemen of Sasquatchery.
Yeah.
But I use more of a correct, I think, classic term. I call them the original four. Because when you think about it, horsemen is something to do with an apocalypse. This has nothing to do with an apocalypse. So I call them the original four. And that is Peter Byrne, John Green, Rene de Hinden, and Dr. Grover Krantz from Washington State University. And I watched that documentary, and I said to myself, I think I saw it when it first came out. I was 9 years old. So this was 2 years into everything. I'm just kind of giving the short version of everything. And I said, that is exactly what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I was hooked ever since. And as the years went on, you know, I kept researching, kept reading. I, you know, my grandfather lived in Edmonton in an apartment, and the mall had a library in it. And I got just about every library book in the Edmonton Public Library system, you know, stacks of books being brought home, videos. I watched every Sasquatch documentary I possibly could find on TV. And, you know, this was before we had satellite TV and Netflix and all that kind of stuff. So when a Sasquatch show was on, I watched it, and it didn't matter what else was on TV. And I was just hooked. And that's what really got me into it. But it really wasn't until, you know, technology, you know, came around, like the iPhone and all that stuff, where I really took the next leap. And this was just recently. So in 2014, my father passed away, and I took some time away from it. And I started getting into a couple other things, and I'd still watch the documentary or whatever, but I wasn't really fully into it as much as I was before.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, I started reaching out to some people. And I started to get a little bit more bolder and ask for, you know, interviews and stuff like that. And one thing led to another, and it just grew and grew and grew. And now, you know, it's fun to be doing it again. And so that's basically how I got into it.
Ah, I mean, I am insanely jealous whenever I speak to most people from North America, Cameron, because I think even if you found one Bigfoot book or Sasquatch book or even a book on cryptozoology in any library, in most places in the United Kingdom, it would be like gold dust, essentially. So whenever I speak to people, I mean, I hear people who go in thrift stores in Canada and they stumble across John Green books and things. And I've never seen a real John Green book, you know, in real life. I've obviously seen them on the internet, but I've never been in a shop and seen one. Mm. I've never seen one for sale. I mean, over here, they're as rare as rocking horse teeth. Really, Cameron, in regards to what you can get. But I think, as you say, I think one of the key things about this subject is, especially in the last 10 to 15 years, the growth of YouTube and also Amazon has really allowed people from around the world to finally go backwards and look at some of the great researchers and the books that were written.
Right.
I often joke on the show that what I thought I knew about this whole topic 3 years ago before I started doing the show, I realize now just how very little I knew. But compared to the average person, I obviously knew quite a lot.
Right.
But
I'd like to think I do too, but that's not always the case.
Well, this is the thing. I think the one thing I've learned especially is that nobody knows everything.
No.
Often the best way to work is to work in a collaborative fashion and reach out to people as you did, build up relationships. And obviously often with any subject, and it's not just Sasquatch or Bigfoot research that sometimes falls down with this. Often some people want to keep everything to themselves, and as you refer to the legendary four, who are the kings of the subject in many people's eyes, were often known for their frictional relationships. But I think often they would get things done, and obviously we're all coming at it from slightly different angles, but when they worked well together, they were a great team. And it's interesting for me that this subject still continues to develop, and people such as yourself, Cameron, come into it. You get the bug. Sometimes you lose your way a little bit for whatever reason. And then all of a sudden the fire's rekindled and you suddenly, as you say, you started to reach out to people, you built relationships up. And that was probably the catalyst that's probably propelled you with a greater passion for the subject, I suspect.
Yeah. When I took my first break, after my father passed away in the summer of 2014, I was trying to get into sports broadcasting because that was something I thought I really wanted to do. And I never got anywhere with it, really. And I kind of found, I talked to a lot of other researchers about this. And, you know, there were some good people that tried to help me in sports broadcasting. There was. But every time I thought I'd try and make progress, I kind of felt like doors were being shut. They didn't really want this young guy coming around or whatever, because sport broadcasting jobs are very hard to get, which I understand. Then from the other side, getting back into my Sasquatch research, they're like begging for young people to come and take over the research, because a lot of the researchers are older.
Yeah,
they're not going to be around forever. So they want somebody to carry the torch. And I like I said, I looked up to, you know, Rene de Hinden, Peter Byrne, John Green, Grover Krantz. I never have personally met any of the original four. Mm-hmm. I have spoken to Peter Byrne one time and interviewed him one time, but we keep in touch through email. But he's 95 years old now.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's not going to be around forever. So I am trying to soak up all his advice and information like a sponge, because there'll become a day where he does pass and it's going to be okay. That's it. The original four are done. And then I would say the next in line, as far as, you know, after the original four, I would say would be Thomas Steenward, Daniel Perez, and John Bindernoggle, who has unfortunately passed away too. I also talked to him quite a bit.
Mm.
He was the first one that I really reached out to. I saw him on a show in Canada. It was a documentary series called Creepy Canada.
Yeah.
And they'd have stories about Sasquatch, UFOs, and all that kind of thing, ghosts, whatever. And I contacted him through his website, and he got back to me, and we corresponded quite a bit. He was the first one that really gave me the time of day to talk about it. And I was only, oh boy, I was only 19 at the time, maybe, or, you know, just in, barely in, out of my teens.
Yeah.
And he pointed me to John Green, and I talked to John Green, the one and only time I ever talked to John Green. But of course, I didn't have an iPhone or anything back then, so I couldn't record our interview. So I'm literally in my old binder. I have notes written,
yeah.
How the interview went and what he said written. And of course, my writing is crap. I could be a doctor. It's that good.
Yeah.
And so I got to interview Bob Gimlin. The one and only time I ever talked to him was in the summer of 2009. I was 18 years old. And now it's harder to get an interview with him. But I'm glad I did. But it's unfortunate I don't have it recorded. But I'll talk a bit later about the Patterson film, because to me, that is one of the most important. I have three key pieces of evidence in my mind that are top three. And we can go into those later if you'd like.
Yeah, no problems. I mean, I'm always impressed, Cameron, because like you say, I've also had the pleasure of speaking with Peter. And I must admit, I've done over 150 episodes of this show, and I've spoken to people, I've got to know some of the best and most intelligent researchers in a variety of fields, from ufology to the paranormal to cryptozoology. And I must admit, Peter was the one that I was probably the most nervous and the most starstruck about.
Yeah. Oh, me too. Yeah, without a doubt.
Because it really was like having a conversation with history for me, because I'd got to know so much, and I'd seen Peter as a young man on documentaries over here.
Right.
And even without the consideration of everything he's done in the field of cryptozoology, his life story itself is incredible.
Oh, it's amazing.
I mean, that man seems to have lived about four lives and achieved more in the last 30 years of his life than most people do in a lifetime, Cameron. So it's,
Correct.
He just astounds me. And the fact that he still has this passion and he's still interested in the subject at 95. And I was speaking with a couple of researchers recently. We were joking about that they weren't getting any younger. And I said, well, perhaps we all need to find out what Peter's, you know, diet tips are, really, to keep us going and keep us so fresh. Because not only is he still so keenly interested in the subject, he's still so sharp. And I find it remarkable, because often we think of our elder statespeople as slowing down as they get older. But when I spoke with Peter, and I know lots of people, and I've heard him interviewed on other shows since, he's still as sharp as a tack. And I find that as remarkable as the fact that he's still so incredibly invested in this subject and spent, you know, 2/3 of his life in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I talked to him, like, I got my interview here. I think I talked to him. I think for about, I talked to him for half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like, to me, it was like talking to God, it felt like. Because, you know, here's a guy that, you know, I read about in books, I've seen on documentaries, I've seen, you know, newspaper articles, old newspaper articles. And now I'm, you know, moving my mouth and talking to him. I just couldn't believe it. And he's such a nice guy. You know, he says, oh, yeah, come on down to so-and-so and, you know, we'll meet for dinner or whatever. And we'll talk, you know, he's so inviting, you know. And if it wasn't for the COVID-19 pandemic, I would have been down there this summer or before, because I would like to meet him before it's too late. But
yeah,
I think I'm hoping to get down there next year, but I'm hoping for the best luck wise.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think, and that's always a, something to wish to arrange, and why not? I think that would be on anybody's bucket list in regards to to the field of cryptozoology, Cameron.
Right. And the thing, you know, what Peter Byrne has done for Sasquatch research, you know, he's really, you know, now that I've done my own research on it and everything, he's really the only one out of the original four that really got any financing to do this.
Yes.
You know, it started with Tom Slick, and then he got some other funding through universities. I think one was through with his friend Robert Ryans, who did a lot of great work, and Tim Dimsdale as well from Loch Ness. And then he got, you know, into the mid to late 90s, you know, he got some funding from, I think, the University of Boston.
Yeah.
So really, there hasn't been another researcher who has had people or investors or anything say, here's some money, go look for it, you know? If I walked up to my provincial government or federal government and did that, they'd throw my butt out of Parliament Hill. You know? It's true, and it's gotten worse, right? You know, because, you know, you say, you know, YouTube isn't exactly the greatest thing either for the Sasquatch research world. Some of it's great, but others of it has been just, you know, just horrible. Yeah. And to be honest, you know, a lot of my family and friends, they say, well, you did, you know, 2-3 years worth of sports broadcast, or 2-3 years trying to do this. Why don't you do one for Bigfoot? I said, no, because that would ruin my reputation faster than anything. Because the market on YouTube for Sasquatch, it's so saturated. I don't want to do that. Like, I run my own personal little, you know, YouTube channel talking about other different things, but I've only done one video about Sasquatch because I just want to stay as professional as I can with this, and don't want to water it down on YouTube. There's a lot of other good people doing YouTube stuff. And I just think it probably wouldn't be taken as seriously, I think, as if I did do YouTube stuff on it.
Yeah. And I think, like you say, it's very difficult because there are some excellent channels out there.
Yes.
Yeah. With some fantastic researchers, as you refer to. There is, as with any subject that's mysterious or interesting, Cameron, there's a lot of crap out there, but you can apply that to any part of the unknown, I suspect, you know, whether it's lake monsters or ghosts or UFOs. You've just got to be, you could basically, as you referred to earlier, you could fall down a rabbit hole and end up believing that Bigfoot have friends, and I know there are channels where people who live in America and Canada claim to be having conversations with Bigfoot and recording them and playing them back.
I'm not going to go there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's as much as I'd like to talk on the subject as well.
Because
one of the most surprising aspects of all this is finding out just how many strands to this subject there are. And if you follow the wrong one, you can end up in a very strange place, Cameron.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. That's why I really follow the philosophy of the original four. And, you know, Thomas Steinberg, he's got a great piece of advice, and it's stick to the facts and never deviate from the facts. That's what his great advice is. And I think that's really helped me along. So,
yeah. So for you, Cameron, when was the sort of first time you ventured out on your own on an investigation or an expedition? Because obviously for a lot of people outside of Canada, you know, obviously I know where Alberta is, and I know that, you know, Edmonton is the main city in the province, and where you are and your position on the continent in regards to your locality and some of the areas and the absolutely jaw-dropping scenery there is there. So for any of us, or anybody that's listening that isn't aware of Alberta, and can you tell us a bit about it and where you've been in regards to this wonderful subject?
And I've learned this in the past, you know, year, because, you know, I've kind of been able to do some traveling around the whole province, not necessarily Sasquatch work related, but just traveling with my girlfriend and seeing lots of different parts of it. You have the north, which is full of boreal forests and lakes and you know, and then you go more southwest and then you hit the Rocky Mountains, you know, you get your Jasper, your Banff, those two places. And then you go to the south and southeast where it's like desert. It's a really incredible province. It's great. I don't have to move to a different one just to see different things. I can get it all in one spot. I've done most of my field work in the Jasper, Banff, Nordegg area, which is along the Canadian Rockies. So it's south, it's west and southwest Alberta. I would say as the years have gone on and you know, the two towns of Banff and Jasper have grown, it's more, obviously Banff. Have you ever been to Banff?
I have yet to visit Canada, sadly, but I doubt it won't be much longer because I've got, like I say, I've got family there and I've also got invitations to hit British Columbia as well. So I'll be there sooner rather than later, all things considered.
So Banff is a very popular and famous tourist attraction in Alberta. It's you know, Lake Louise. It's the tourist Rocky Mountain area of Alberta. And being down there, like, I've noticed as I've gone around in the woods there, I don't think there's as many Sasquatch roaming around there as there used to be because of the development, because of the tourist area. I still think there's some in the area, but I think they mostly pass through.
Mm.
As far as Jasper goes, which is more north of Banff, I think they're more prominent there. Jasper isn't as crazy and touristy as Banff. I'd put it this way. Jasper is the small, quiet kind of ski town with some tourist stuff, where Banff is the Las Vegas of Alberta.
Right.
You get people there from all over the world, which is, you know, great for the Alberta economy and stuff. But as far as trying to find Sasquatch, it's not the greatest because, you know, you got your big tour buses and noise and whatever. And
yep.
But it's still a very vast, very mountainous terrain. I think the best spot, and I think I've talked about it with other researchers, there's a little mining town called Nordegg, Alberta, just a small little mining town. It's not a tourist thing like Banff and Jasper.
Yep.
And the area there is unbelievable. I went there for the first time 2 years ago. My girlfriend took me to a place called Abraham Lake, where there have been reports in the area for years and years and years.
Yep.
And I get such a different feeling going there than I do at Jasper or Banff. Because when you go to Jasper or Banff, you know, it's a tourist towns, right? This is not a tourist town. This is middle of the mountains. It has a gas station. It's growing a little bit, but it's still nowhere near Lake Jasper or Banff. And it's a different feel. I guess you could say my real first investigation was from a report from 1969, where it was actually on the front cover of the Edmonton Journal of August 25th or August 30th of 1969. They were building the Bighorn Dam, which is this huge dam, you know, in Alberta,
yep,
not far from Nordegg.
Mm-hmm.
And have you heard about that report before?
Well, as soon as you said the term Nordegg, that was what I was thinking, because I'm aware that if that seems to have been a bit of a hotspot at some time in the past.
I wouldn't say just the past. It's still a hotspot, and I'll get to that in a second.
Good.
So I went down there to do my own investigation of the site where this happened. I mean, this happened years before I ever showed up.
Yeah.
But I wanted to, because I read about it in books and things like that, and I wanted to go down and see it for myself, just to say I've been there. Thomas Steenberg's been down there multiple times. So I went down there. My girlfriend took me down there for the day, and I did my investigating and whatever, and she went and did her own thing. So I talked to Thomas the night before I went down there, and he said, you know, I don't think anybody's ever been on the other side of the ridge. And I said, well, I'll do it. You know, I was thinking, why would nobody ever walk around and look around this thing? So I took photographs, I took video, and it's so different now from what it was back then. It's a campground now.
Mm.
It was like all these people camping on the near this ridge where this sighting took place. And I'm about probably, I would say 99.9% sure that everybody camping there had no idea they were in the spot that they were in. And knowing it's actually the most famous and well-known report in all of Alberta Sasquatch history, because it was on the front page of the Edmonton Journal. There were five witnesses to this. The story goes, long story short, there was five construction workers. While they were building the Bighorn Dam, they see this thing on a ridge just walking back and forth, watching them. And it was huge, black creature. and they reported it estimated height to be 15 feet tall. Now, what happened was they didn't have any way of measuring this. One guy tried to go back and get binoculars or go get some sort of better viewing device, and they could see it through the, I don't know if it was a scope or a, you know, a tripod sight seeing thing, and they just saw this thing watching them, and they watched, I think, for about a half an hour or more, just walking back and forth on this ridge, watching them, and it would stop. And I think it sat down, and then all of a sudden it got up and walked to the left back into the forest. So, and then all of a sudden this was huge news, you know, all the, you know, wow, 15 foot tall Sasquatch seen in Alberta. Eh? And the only problem is then why this, I mean, it may not have been 15 feet. This was just their estimation in height, but of course the press ran with it, right?
Yeah.
You know, what are you going to, what's going to make the bigger headline, a little 6.5 foot Sasquatch or a 15 foot tall Sasquatch? So, but the odd thing is, in talking with Thomas Steenbergen and Ken Walker, I think this was from Thomas Steenberg's files, from the late, I believe, 1940s till about 1984, there were a lot of reports of over average height Sasquatches sighted in that area. Everything from 8 feet tall to 16 feet tall in that area. Then all of a sudden, from after 1984, those height sightings dropped. They just fell. Just no more huge Sasquatches. They were still getting Sasquatch reports, but nothing along the lines of, you know, 15 to 16 feet. So, and, you know, and it's weird because I don't know if it was Ken Walker, Thomas Steenberg told me a story where there was a gentleman who was driving. I don't know if he was driving home or something like that. He was on the main highway between the Nordegg area and all that. All of a sudden, all this family of Sasquatches comes across the road in front of his car. And he said they were so tall, he had to look up through his windshield, and they were looking down on him. He estimated them to be about 13 to 15 feet tall. And he said they, and so it was a family of them crossing a road, and all in that height. So I don't know if you ever read a book. I forget who written it. It was The Field Guide to Bigfoot and Other Mysterious Monsters. And the author categorized, I should have grabbed the book before we started. He categorized, I've read it so much I can remember it. So he categorized all these, I'll say, Sasquatch-like creatures in different categories. And one of the categories was called true giants.
CODA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Yeah.
Which I believe was anything 8 feet tall and over. And I think at one point in this area, from a certain amount of time, there was a category of certain types of Sasquatch species that was considered a true giant, that was taller than your regular smaller ones. I mean, it makes sense. You got, we have different sizes of people.
Yeah.
Why couldn't we have different sizes of Sasquatch?
Yeah. Well, I think that's often something that's never really sort of delved into, because often when we hear reports from other parts of North America, Cameron, there tends to be a tendency to consider anything that's normal size, which is, you know, between 5 and 6.5 feet, are often right, described as being a juvenile. People just presume it must be a juvenile, because for a lot of people, I think the average perception of what a Sasquatch is an 8 to 9 foot tall, hairy biped walking around in the forested areas or the localities, right, and mountains. So it is interesting that there does seem to be this cutoff point for a lot of people, that anything above 9 feet seems to be stretching the bounds of credibility. And I think often you have a danger of, as you refer to, when you look at any other creature around the world, there will always be incidents and examples of giganticism,
right,
even in a gigantic creature, be it a feral hog or a wolf or a giraffe or an elephant or a shark, there will always be larger ones out there. So Why wouldn't there be something that pushes those boundaries? So
right. And it's not only pushing boundaries. It's just a matter of fact. But, you know, elephants aren't born at adult height.
Mm-hmm.
You know, giraffes aren't born at adult height. So why would a Sasquatch not be born at gigantic? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They have to be small. You know, it's like when they find these rare cases of juvenile footprints. Sasquatch isn't born with, you know, 14 to 16 half feet. They have, they need time to grow. So why wouldn't there? And I mean, what's really intriguing about it is from Thomas Steinberg's files, after 1984, nothing was really seen of that height. So did this, you know, subspecies of Sasquatch die off, or did they just move out of the area and all that's left are, you know, your generic, for me, Sasquatch, I think for females, a range anywhere from 5 to 6.5 feet, where the males get anywhere from 7 to possibly, maybe, I guess realistic number would be 8.5 feet.
Mm.
But who's to say there isn't more 12 to 15 feet ones walking around somewhere?
Absolutely. And as you refer to, a lot of these sightings seem to have coincided around that particular area,
right,
when they were building the dam.
Right.
And we often see parallels in the natural world, Cameron, where creatures will move away from the encroachment of humans in whatever kind of situation it is, to try and go. And obviously, one of the other aspects of Canada is the further north you get, the less people you're going to find. You know, you haven't got
Correct.
Far to go. And if we're talking about a creature that is adapted to living in the wilds of Canada in some of the most ferocious winter conditions in the Northern Hemisphere, why wouldn't they then sort of gravitate further out of the way? Because nobody's going
right.
to into the Northern Territories and Saskatchewan, pushing further into those, into the Arctic Circle, basically just getting out of the way, because once you get past sort of the middle of Canada, you're near enough on your own.
That's right. Like, personally, I've only gone as far as Ontario eastward for Canada. I've never been to Quebec or Atlantic Canada, and I've only gone as far north as, I'm just trying to think how far north I really get, Cold Lake, Alberta, which is northeast. I went there fishing this summer, and there's actually a couple of reports that came out of that area, I believe, in the mid to late 70s. There were footprints found in that area. How legit they are, we don't really know. But I think you're absolutely right, because the more north you go, there isn't that many that much people.
Mm.
So who's to say they're not? There could be, you know, we could be, all us researchers could be looking in all the wrong spaces. You know, we're all concentrated on, you know, Southwestern BC and Southwestern Alberta and things. Maybe we should be going more north than we should be.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I kind of have a theory. I mean, if you pull up a map of Alberta and you look at it, and it has to be, you know, with all the towns and whatever, I think, at least the Alberta Sasquatch, I'm just totally speaking in Alberta terms, I think they have a territory as far north west as Grand Prairie and more. That's a northwest town in Alberta, all the way south, southwest is Waterton Lakes National Park. I think that's a huge territory ground for them to cover, and we have definitely not explored that entire range. And I think they're somewhat migratory, if that's the correct word. And I think they go back and forth. I mean, Ken Walker told me an incident where there's a highway stretch, I believe it's Highway 43, between Lake Fort Assiniboine and Swan Hills.
Yeah.
So you're going northwest to southwest, or southeast, kind of.
Yeah.
And these hunters and people have seen Sasquatch going back and forth across the road all the time, chasing the deer, hunting the deer down. And I said, well, that makes perfect sense, because, you know, my dad worked up there in the oil, and there was nothing up there. You know, I would like to check out that road, that highway, personally, just to see the scenery. And, you know, here's how I kind of do my, I guess you could say, scouting or investigations. I'll go through an area and I'll think to myself, okay, what does it have here? Does it have water? Yes or no. Does it have coverage? Yes or no. Does it have enough food supply? Yes or no. But also, what's near here? If there's big cities or big towns or whatever, there's not going to be a Sasquatch in the vicinity. But if it's more secluded and has all those things, then you could kind of think, okay, it's possible they could be around here, or they could have been around here at one point. That's kind of how I judge an area where I go.
Yeah. I mean, I spoke to Doug Hychek, who's obviously the gentleman who's responsible for Monster Quest and many others.
Yes. Yeah, I've interviewed him as well. Great guy. Yeah. He's the one I actually want to try and get my book published by.
Yeah. He had his encounter, if you can call it that, because obviously he found a trail of footprints when he went filming in the Northwest Territory. And obviously the thing about that was he knew for a fact that there was nobody around where he was. You know, he'd flown into a lake. That was the only way you could get there. You couldn't walk there. And often, Cameron, one of those stupid explanations that gets thrown about, and, you know, even if we go back to the days of Sanderson and Green, you know, people were saying, oh, well, there's just people going out, leaving footprints. And you're thinking, who in their right mind, even if you even consider this to be an acceptable explanation, which I don't, primarily because it's as ludicrous as dismissing this subject out of hand. Who in their right mind is going to fly to a lake in northern Canada on the off chance that somebody else is going to turn up and come across some footprints next to a lake? It's ridiculous to even consider that as a valid explanation, Cameron.
That's right. And not only that, I think Dr. Robert Krantz had a saying one time. He said he looked at the idea of Sasquatch to be, I could be getting it wrong, where basically his conclusion was, well, then the ridiculous must be true.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, something like that. I forget the full quote, but and that's just it. And not only that, so you say these people go up there and leave these footprints, but yeah, like why would, so, and not only that, thinking that somebody's going to find them. Up in northern Canada, there's wind, there's snow, there's rain. It would destroy whatever footprints you'd left behind, hoping someone to find anyways.
Yep.
So, you know, I totally believe Doug Hijack found or came across something, because I looked on a map where this was, and I'm like, yeah, there's no way there's going to be a barefooted person walking around there.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of those things that when you hear people, when they have these experiences, and you deal with people who are experienced hunters and fishermen and outdoors people, Cameron, you know, these people go into the middle of nowhere often for a variety of reasons. Why would any, you know, and it's quite remote. These people might go somewhere for a week and not see another human being other than somebody they're with in their party. So
that's right.
How on earth we're supposed to accept that, you know, hoaxers are running around the most far out places in North America, hoping that some people come wandering past.
Exactly.
Before it rains is crazy, in my opinion.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, remember back when Ray Wallace passed away and his family came out and says, okay, we created Bigfoot, da-da-da-da, we left all these tracks. Well, then you're telling me he made the ones in Florida, he made the ones in Alabama, he made the ones in, you know, Manitoba, Canada, he made the ones, you know. So he must have went and traveled all over the world doing this, eh?
Yep.
And then they go, you know what I mean? Yeah, see, gotcha.
Yeah, absolutely. He must have some hell of air miles on his cards, Cameron. Definitely. He must have been the world's most frequent flyer to get away with that.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's why I never really believed that. I mean, maybe, he could have hoaxed some tracks, but he was not responsible for. Hmm. And that's the thing, the news. This is what ticks me off with, and some of us other researchers with the media and news. Ray Wallace did not create Sasquatch or Bigfoot. That was going on long before us white men even arrived. And that's what the media, some media, fails to see and recognize.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is not, and I've talked to a couple of First Nations people.
Yeah.
Just last weekend, a couple weekends ago at work, I talked to a customer. I work in a retail world, and he explained what Sasquatch was to them and what's in their culture, and he told me some very interesting things, and I full-heartedly believe him. I have no reason to doubt a First Nations person. Yeah,
absolutely.
I'm more skeptical about a white man seeing Sasquatch than I would be a First Nations person.
Yeah. I think, like you say there, you can kind of bookend this modern media version of Bigfoot or Sasquatch or whatever they want to call it, depending on which news outlet's covering it. Cameron, whereas they seem to think it started in 1958 and then Ray Wallace finished it in 2008, and that's it.
Yeah.
It's just these 50 years.
Yeah, I believe he passed away in 2000 or 2003 or something like that. And I've seen one documentary. It was horribly done. That said, the Sasquatch got started in 1967 when Patterson film came out. And I just laughed. I'm like, all right, that's all I need to watch of this one.
Yeah, yeah. And it I do find it's very, it's almost as if there's a mainstream media version of this subject. And then there's everything that anybody, if anybody takes the time to even look past normal media, Cameron, as soon as you open those gates, you know that everything that they've said is nonsense. You know, everybody, you know, there are hundreds and hundreds of reports that go back to the 18th and 19th centuries in North American newspapers.
You know, and even 17th century, 16th, and what goes far back as Leif Erikson and the Vikings. And there was something I was read one time where I think it would have been Leif Erikson or whatever came to Newfoundland or whatever, and he heard stories of Sasquatch. Yeah. Like Newfoundland, Canada, that's miles and miles away from British Columbia.
Absolutely. And but it's the same in the US as well, you know. A lot of people think, oh, well, it's only in Oregon and Washington, and they have no concept of the cases in California, in Utah, the things that are going on in the southern states of Alabama and Mississippi and Florida and Georgia and the Carolinas, Cameron. Either we've got a gang of highly sophisticated hoaxers infiltrating every state and province in North America, or there's something very strange going on.
Yeah, and that's just, I mean, I have a heart, I mean, I will be, I'm trying to find a nice way to say this. I focus more on the Pacific Northwest and Alberta and stuff. There's a part of me that has a harder time with the Sasquatch in, like, you know, Florida, Alabama, that kind of thing, because to me, that's not the right habitat. But then who's to say what is their right habitat? You know, if they're trying to be elusive and not be found by humans, I guess they would hide anywhere. But I mostly stick to Alberta, BC, and that kind of thing, because that's, you know, that's within my, you know, region and within my travel area. You know, I'm not saying all things from, you know, Florida, Alabama, and, you know, all that stuff is fake. That's not what, but I've always personally had a harder time believing that. I think it's because, you know, when you think of Sasquatch or you think of Bigfoot, you think mountains, you think forests, you think that. You don't think swamp bogs in Florida, right?
But I think the other aspect of this is if we're dealing with some kind of creature, as you were referring to about the difference in potential sizes of it, I think often people will call anything that's hairy and upright Bigfoot or Sasquatch. And it's
correct,
because a lot of the reports in the southern states, we don't get these 7-8 foot creatures. They usually they're 5 and 6 foot, aren't they? And they seem to be a bit stranger, and they act a bit differently, and they seem to shout a lot and chase people a lot. So for me, whilst I consider them under that umbrella of the whole Bigfoot Sasquatch phenomenon, I think if we are to deal with these cases, I think there are different types. There has to be.
Yes, exactly.
Even based on what we know about the natural world, the same breed of animal can be very different in different areas. And America and Canada are a massive continent.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you only have to look at the difference, the difference of states in their temperatures and their climates and their habitats.
That's right.
To have even a basic understanding that animals will react and adapt differently in different areas. So why
that's
not
right.
are they going to be, why wouldn't they be smaller and slightly stranger, it would seem?
Right. Absolutely. And I mean, to go back, and I'm not laying shade on, you know, southern United States, because there are a lot of great accounts from down there, and there are First Nations stories from those states. I'm just more focused on Alberta and BC, because that's where I'm from. That's where I'm close to. But I have heard of the skunk ape. I have heard of Momo. I have read those stories. The Falk monster of Arkansas, the creature of Boggy Creek. And there is a lot of, you know, I say, you know, there's a lot of, you know, rugged and whatever places, areas in Alberta and BC. Well, there is a lot of area down there, too, that's never been explored and wild and rugged. So, you know, who's to say they're not there?
Absolutely.
That may be the place where they prove it. And then, you know, us Canadians will be like, oh, we lost. You know? That would just tick, you know, us Canadians would just be just ticked if that was where Sasquatch was discovered, in Florida or Alabama or Falk, Arkansas or something like that. That would be embarrassing.
Yeah, well.
You know, then we'd be like, okay, well, at least they found it. It's over. It's done. So I guess that's, you know, us Canadians, we're very proud people. We, you know, Sasquatch is distinctively Canadian.
Yeah.
And we're the only, you know, we're the ones that came up with, well, J.W. Burns was the ones that came up with, was the one that came up with the name Sasquatch, but he was Canadian. And so, and that's the thing. So when I first started contacting Thomas Steinberg and interviewing him, I made the mistake of calling it Bigfoot. Well, that did not go over well. And ever since then, I've said Sasquatch. And even when I've you know, because he's the American name is Bigfoot. Don't call it that. It's Sasquatch. Okay. Thank you. All right, Mr. Steinberg, my apologies. So, but he's right, though. And ever since then, I've called it Sasquatch. I've hardly ever used the name Bigfoot.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it is very interesting for me. I love these variations in different areas. And like you, for me, I tend to sort of agree with you in regards to the Sasquatch's stomping ground's going to be in the Northwest, somewhere right around there. And I've, you know, looked at all those reports and spoken to some of the best researchers in this field down there. And there's clearly something different going on. It's similar, but it's different for me.
Yes, it is.
So I kind of understand. And I mean, like you say, you've got Alberta and British Columbia next to each other, which for anybody in the world of Sasquatch, especially in Canada, they are the ground zero, aren't they? So as you were referring right to about Nordic and the Bighorn Dam area, are there any other particular hotspots in Alberta, Cameron, where we have a long history of sightings and encounters? Or is it something, as you refer to, that they seem to have changed from being a settled population to being more transient?
Right. Well, I think, because, you know, obviously Alberta is not as big as BC. BC is really the hot spot. Harrison Hot Springs, Sasquatch Provincial Park, you know, that's really where ground zero is.
Mm.
Alberta just, you know, for me, you know, Alberta, it's, sometimes Alberta is kind of the forgotten, you know, province in all this sometimes, because, you know, when you think Sasquatch, what's the first? British Columbia. You don't think Alberta. So I guess my kind of work is to, you know, let people know that there is more here in Alberta than what people think or what they see.
Mm.
As far as Alberta goes and hotspots, I've really only have heard of a couple, and that being the Nordegg area and kind of a little bit more north, like the Swan Hills, Fort Assiniboine, that kind of area. Me personally, I've mostly done my work in, you know, Jasper, Banff, and Nordegg area. So
mm.
I think Alberta is kind of limited as far as hotspots go, because our mountain range is more south and southwest. I mean, I'm in Edmonton, which is about, you know, it's 4 hours away from Banff,
mm-hmm.
three to three and a half to Jasper, which is, it's short drive, but it's not long. It's long too. So I think the more you go into BC, you get more of the hot spots because it's different terrain.
Yeah.
It's more rainforest. Like it's more, where Alberta's like, you know, boreal forests and mountains, in BC it's mountains and rainforest. So you get two different, really different environments. And who's to say Sasquatch goes to certain ones at different times of the year? Maybe he likes the rainforest more in that, in the BC ones, and, you know, your spring and summer, where he'll come to Alberta, or maybe no, sorry, he'll stay in Alberta areas kind of more so in the summer, and then go to like BC in the winter where there's not as much snow.
Mm.
So that's just me thinking out loud. But to be honest, I would say Nordegg area is kind of the one big hotspot for Alberta. We kind of just, cause it's more, we don't have as many mountain ranges as BC does.
Yeah.
Cause then once you get into BC, you get into Northern California, you get into, you know, Washington State, you get into Oregon and that's where you really get the Sasquatch hotspots is in there. So I hate to disappoint you, but I think Alberta only has a couple.
Oh, it's not disappointing. It's interesting because,
yeah,
like I say, you know, other than the work that Thomas has done, over the years, you know, looking at a lot of reports in that British Columbia and Alberta. It's very interesting that I think when you sort of look at this subject just on face value, Cameron, you can sometimes make the miscomprehension of understanding the range of it, because a lot of people go, well, why don't we hear things from Quebec or Saskatchewan or,
right,
you know, up in the north?
No, and there are reports from, I mean, I think there's about 6 or 10 reports from Nova Scotia and Atlantic Canada and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But like I said, I stick more closer to home. But who's to say there isn't, you know, there isn't Sasquatch? I mean, last time I checked, the only places that haven't had in the world, as far as North America goes, Canada, United States, that hasn't had an official Sasquatch sighting was Hawaii.
Yes.
Then I think there's been one report in all 50 states and all provinces of Canada. So, I mean, somebody's got it. And who's to say that, you know, the person may have saw them while they were traveling through, or maybe at one point they had some there.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think. So there are definitely some wild places in Quebec. I've never been to Quebec, but I do know they do have some good forested areas, a lot of good hunting there.
Mm-hmm.
Same with Saskatchewan. I mean, you know, people, like, I just traveled through all the southern part of Saskatchewan this past summer.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it is very flat in some places, so I will give you that. But there are some, the more northern you go, it's like northern Alberta, boreal forests, lots of lakes,
mm-hmm.
a couple national parks. So there have been reports of Sasquatch in Saskatchewan, and majority of them are in the northern portion of the province. There's a couple in the southern province, part of the province. But I tend to think if there is Sasquatch in Saskatchewan, it would definitely be in the northern part more than the south. Because when you get to the south, you could see for miles. Because it is flat. You could see your wife leaving for 3 weeks.
I mean, in regards to your development, as you were referring to at the beginning, Cameron, you've been building up relationships with other Bigfoot researchers. And obviously,
right,
someone else that's been a great support to you is Daniel Perez, who's also been on
right.
the show. So how did you get to talk to Daniel, and where have you gone in regards to your working relationship?
Right. So I first saw Daniel Perez, I think, on Sasquatch Odyssey. They were showing a part where he was running one of the symposiums.
Yeah.
And then I kind of saw him through other documentaries and stuff. And then I got talking to, you know, Thomas Steinberg and Peter Byrne or whatever. And it kind of led me to get to contact him. And so, and of course, I signed up for his newsletter, the Bigfoot Times, which is the only still in print paper news related thing on Sasquatch. Highly recommended.
Absolutely.
No, Daniel Perez did not pay me to say that.
No, I completely agree with her. It's an invaluable resource, the Bigfoot Times.
Exactly. So I basically just kept in contact with through email, and I interviewed him, and, you know, he's so great. You know, he's never said no to an interview or anything. He's like, he's been so helpful, especially recently with one thing that I'm investigating, and I won't go too much into it because it's still in progress per se. And basically what happened was there was a gentleman that contacted me because he saw my poster at the Bighorn Dam gas station on their First Nation reserve.
Yeah.
And he found some hair, and he thought was Sasquatch, possibly Sasquatch hair, and broken trees, limbs. He had his father sighted a Sasquatch, I believe, in something. And this was in the Nordegg area. It's all in the Nordegg area.
Mm-hmm.
And not far at all from where the famous sighting happened with the 5 construction workers in 1969 at the Bighorn Dam.
Mm.
So I interviewed him. His name is Reagan Lundy. And so I've been trying to investigate that. And that's kind of been going on since August, and some other stuff has gone on, but Daniel Perez has been really helpful for me in this investigation. Same with Thomas Steinberg. We're hoping to get some news about the hares at some point. They're kind of in the hands of others right now. I couldn't get down to the site to meet him to collect the hares because, like Grover Krantz said one time, whoever shoots or kills the first Sasquatch is going to get a huge bit of money. But whoever shoots or kills the second one is going to jail.
Yes.
and I'm not saying I am absolutely non-kill. I would not want to be the person that did that. I may want to be the guy that may have stumbled, found one in the woods that has passed away of natural causes, but I would not want to be the guy who would shoot Sasquatch, because that person I think would go through a lot of trouble. And I, on a documentary, Rene de Hinden was told by Roger Patterson, anybody who shoots a Sasquatch wouldn't live 6 months, because Patterson figured somebody would assassinate him. Because it would be such a huge story.
Yeah.
And they're so big, and the world it's not like what it is today, where you have so many people, caring for the environment and everything like that, which is totally fine.
Mm-hmm.
But Roger Patterson thought whoever killed the Sasquatch wouldn't live 6 months, and he figured that person would be assassinated.
I think whatever, as you say, I've often, primarily because as someone that has a deep interest in the natural world and the world around us and our impact and our footprint anyway, Cameron, I think it's vitally important that, because you can't work on the presumption that, God forbid, if anybody does get a situation where they have a creature in their sights or whatever, with the greatest respect, they don't know if that's the last one, or it could be the only one in that particular area.
Exactly.
And how the ramifications, as you say, I think there would be such an outpouring of anger from so many people in the whole, people who are interested in the subject, people who research the subject, people who investigate the subject, people from different cultures, different walks of life, different areas.
Correct.
There would be such an outpouring of anger that I think you're quite right. And I've always said that whoever finds the first one, let's hope they find it in a situation where, it's conclusively proven. But
right.
As you say, I think the first person that ever gets there is going to be set for life. And as with anything, whoever finishes second is going to be eating crumbs off the table, unfortunately.
Right. And I'm not one of those guys that are out there looking. I'd like to find, I'll admit, sure, I'd love to find Sasquatch. I'd love to be the guy that found it. But at the same time, there's been so many people that have helped me get to that point. I wouldn't say, oh, look what I did, or look what I did. This is years and years and decades of research work and papers drawn up and, things like that. It wouldn't be, oh, look what I did, I do have a plan. If I ever was the person to discover it, I know exactly where it would go. I know exactly what I would do, and I'd retire.
Yes.
I would rather capture Bigfoot alive than dead. But the thing is, what are you going to do with a live Sasquatch? It's not a Harry and the Hendersons video. This thing would tear cages. I don't think it'd be, I think the discovery will happen one day. It'll happen when you least expect it. And just like anything. And I'm just here to say, I wouldn't kill one. I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Unless it was like, coming after me and attacking, and it's self-defense, and that might be a different story.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, absolutely. We've all seen Willow Creek. Nobody wants to be in that situation.
Actually, I've never seen Willow Creek. And sounding like what it sounds like, maybe I'm not a scary movie kind of guy. I'm more of the Harry and the Hendersons kind of Sasquatch movie kind of guy.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking, well, I'd heard a lot about it, and I thought, all right, and I must admit, halfway through, I was thinking, right, okay, and then the last half, it's one of the few, because I love scary films as well, I'm a big horror
fan. Fair enough.
But I have to say, the last half really put the willies up me. It really, and the ending, I was like, oh my God. So, anyway.
Now I guess I have to watch it. I guess I'll be watching it in broad daylight on a nice sunny day with the windows open. And,
Yeah, watch it in high summer.
Yes, exactly.
Plenty of daylight, Cameron, plenty of daylight.
Yeah, exactly.
So as you were referring to in regards to evidence, you've caught some photos. Now, were these from British Columbia, as you say?
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the East and North sides, including the Eastern and Polaris corridors,
Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Right. So I'll tell you the backstory on this. So this was the first time I went to BC in years and years and years. So my girlfriend and I, this was our first trip together somewhere. We stopped in Jasper. It's the first time I ever went to Jasper in my life. It was in the summer of 2019. Mm-hmm. And then the next day we went to a place called Valemont, BC, which is just outside of Jasper. It's not very far, mm-hmm. about an hour, maybe hour and a half to 2 hours from Jasper. And you go through Mount Robson Provincial Park and you see Mount Robson, one of the biggest mountains, I believe, in British Columbia or Canada, I believe. Could be wrong on the last part, but I believe it's the tallest mountain in British Columbia, is Mount Robson. So we stay over the night in Valemont. We stay in a nice little cabin, had a nice little fire. Woke up because we had to head back home the next day. We stopped and had breakfast at this really nice cafe, headed home. So my girlfriend, she really likes rivers and water and that kind of thing. So she wanted to stop at this, on the highway, they had this roadside stop where you can walk along the river. I believe it was the Nelson or Fraser River. And I can never pronounce the name. It's the Tetuine Cache Roadside. It's a First Nations name, I believe. And that area itself is very famous for Sasquatch. It's where William Rowe had his sighting in 1955. That whole area, it was right in that area. So I'm like, yeah, let's stop. We got, you know, a 5-hour drive ahead of us. You know, we might as well stop and enjoy, you know, stretch our legs good and enjoy the last bit of mountain scenery and whatever. So we pulled over. It's just a roadside stop. You go down a little bit of a, not a hill, but kind of an embankment, let's call it. And you go to the bottom of this embankment and you're right on the, I believe, the Fraser or Nelson River. So we're watching the river and it's very beautiful scenery. We got the main highway in Canada, the Trans-Canada Highway, Yellowhead Highway 1, yeah, Highway 16 behind us. Some parts of the country, it's Highway 1. Some parts, it's Highway 16, Yellowhead. People who are listening, who are Canadian, might live in Alberta, know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So I'm letting my girlfriend do her thing. I'm always walking around, you know, looking for possible Sasquatch stuff, right? I'm in the mountains. That's my natural instinct. So I'm walking back up the other side of this embankment, we'll call it, and I look to my left. And on the ground, I see what I think is an imprint. And I call my girlfriend over. I say, are you looking at what I'm seeing? She says, yeah. I said, okay, hold this. I take out my big camera. So when I go research Sasquatch, I usually carry 3 cameras, sometimes 4. My regular iPhone camera. A nice big Nikon photography camera. And I have this old DVD camcorder that my dad got my family for Christmas in like 2007 or whatever. It's ancient technology, but I still use it. So I start taking pictures and video. And I look at this and I'm going, oh my goodness, what am I seeing? And I just get the hair on my arms just stand up. And then I look to my right and in the corner is these matted down grasses and tree bushes. And I'm thinking, no way. So before I go into full Sasquatch mode, I look around. So I tell my girlfriend, just stand here, wait here. I don't want to lose this possible imprint. I don't want to lose my spot.
Yeah.
In this parking lot, there was also a small bus with a trailer on it. I believe it could have been whitewater rafters or something like that. I walked around and it rained. I know it rained previously 3 days or so prior to my girlfriend and I being in the area because we were watching the weather, you know, what to pack. Do we need rain gear? That sort of thing. I walk around the bus. I see nothing like what I see back there in the ground on the embankment.
Yeah.
Because I wanted like, if it's whitewater rafters or whatever, walking barefoot, then it's like, okay, well, that did not see any of that. And there was legit mud around there because it rained. There was no barefoot print tracks whatsoever.
Yeah.
So I go back to this embankment where I think the track is, and I look at it, and I just go, oh, my goodness, this could be it. So I very carefully follow it. Now, it washed out. It, like, as you can see in the picture, it's kind of gravel-type material.
Yeah.
Some dirt, but mostly gravel material. So I just followed what these impressions right through the parking lot of this area. It goes across Highway 16 Yellowhead, down over a guardrail on the highway, up the mountain embankment, and it has a game trail, zigzag-like game trail, and it goes all the way up there. And I thought, oh my God, I found it. So I could totally be wrong. It could be washed out from rain. But, you know, everybody that I've showed it to in the research world says, yeah, you might have something. Now, the only problem is that was the only good one that I saw intact.
Yeah.
Because it was covered by a little bit of foliage and that kind of thing. And then I go and take a picture of what I... So this is what I presumably think. I think between 3 to 5 days prior to my girlfriend getting there, there was a Sasquatch there. It came down from the game trail up on the mountain, crossed the highway, went over the guardrail, crossed the highway, took a drink from the Nelson or Fraser River, wherever I was, went and had a nap, and then went back up the embankment and crossed the highway and went back up the mountain. Now, I could totally be wrong, and it was nothing, and I was just saying, but that's the only possible track that I have found in my almost 20 years of... I've been doing this since fall of 1997. It's now late fall of 2021. That's the only thing that I have found to this date, personally.
So far, Cameron. So far.
So far. So far. So far. So, but it was just so... I'll say it. I personally think it's... I don't think it was a very big Sasquatch. I think it could have been a young teenage one, possibly a younger female. I don't think it was a big male because it was not a very big track. And I was stupid. I'd made a rookie mistake and I didn't have any measuring equipment, which is why I took a picture with my phone with my big camera.
Yeah.
And ever since, I keep a measuring tape in my girlfriend's glove compartment now in her car, because if I come across that, because that's the thing, we can't really tell the size.
Yeah.
The toes, I know, were a little washed out, but I can clearly see what looks like an Easter egg shaped big toe. There's a stick also squished in the footprint.
Yeah.
There's a twig. So yeah, that's been my one find. And I haven't, and it was, and it's interesting. I think it holds some weight because that area is had some history for Sasquatch sightings. It's in the mountains. It's near water. And so is it one? It possibly could be, I don't know, but I took a picture of it just in case.
Yeah. What's the area like, Cameron? Is it busy? Is it a residential area? Is it just a thoroughfare?
No, this is out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like there's literally the Nelson or the river, whatever river.
Yeah.
Then the highway. There's the closest town is Valemont.
Yeah. How far away is that?
I think we were about a half an hour away from Valemont.
Yeah. So you're talking, what, 20, 30 miles at least?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's one, it's like the highway curves, the main highway curves around a big mountain. So it's there's no big cities near there.
Yeah.
And it's near, and the other side of that is the boundary of Mount Robson Provincial Park.
Intriguing.
Whether it's one, I don't know for this day, but I mean, if that's the only thing I find, then at least I could say, well, I possibly may have found a footprint, and at least I've got something.
Yeah. Well, it's a great place to start, and I don't think you should be too hard on yourself. You've got plenty of years of investigation and research ahead of you, Cameron. So who knows what may happen?
Well, I would like to make a find or have this wrapped up before. I don't know if I want to be like Mr. Byrne at 95, and if I make it that far and still looking, there are other things I'm into, and it'd be great if we did make a find while I was still young and able to move around like the wind, that kind of thing. So
yeah,
but it's fun to do.
Absolutely. I know earlier you were referring about the key pieces of things,
right?
Evidence that you've seen, and obviously you mentioned Patson Gimlin, which I think is obviously the gold standard in regards to this. So what are the other two that intrigue you or make you think there's far more to this than just misidentification and other such skeptical explanations, Cameron?
Well, it's obviously with the Patterson film, it's something we can visually see and something that has, you know, stood the test of time. I mean, I think it's the film itself. So next year will be 55 years.
Yes, it will.
And I don't think two broke ex-rodeo cowboys could fake that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do have my own saying I go by. And I think it applies more to more modern day evidence than past. But that saying I have is never underestimate a hoaxer.
Yep.
Never underestimate a hoaxer.
Mm-hmm.
Because nowadays with computers, with CGI, with whatever, it is easier to fake things.
Mm.
But back in 1967, no way.
Okay.
So I think obviously the Patterson film is number one. Number two would be the 1969 Bosberg Cripple Tracks.
Yep.
I know that kind of has some researchers are kind of iffy on that because Ivan Marks was involved,
yep.
That kind of thing.
Yep.
But what people have to remember is Ivan Marks was not the hoaxer that he turned out to be back in 1969.
No, that's very true.
And keep in mind, Rene de Hinden found these tracks. And Ivan Marks didn't say, oh, let's go take a look over here. They were literally just driving around. And de Hinden, I believe, saw something out of the car. And he told Ivan Marks to stop. And these tracks went through and this was in, I believe, December of 1969 or in the middle of winter. This was not a nice summer day in Bosberg, Washington. This was winter time.
Yeah.
These tracks went through mountains, through cold streams, cold rivers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who would walk barefoot in a cold stream or river in December? You'd get frostbite instantly.
Yeah.
So I think the Bosberg tracks, I think, need to be brought up more than what they are. I think it's because it has the Ivan Marks involved in the story. It kind of is tainted. I think it's an unfair taint.
Mm. Yeah.
I think because Rene de Hinden was the one that found them, and then Grover Krantz came. Like, those were the tracks that took Grover Krantz from maybe thinking Sasquatch was real to 10% to 100%.
Yeah, yeah. There are some very compelling parts to it as well, as you say, because, I mean, the other aspect is who would think, well, if they are going to fake it, why would they make it a deformed footprint? Why would they go through all this palaver of creating this long trackway, as you say? Because if you look into Bosberg, you discover just, you know, it goes in and out of ice. It goes into the river. It comes out of the river. That's a hell of a stretch to go, oh, well, somebody, as you say, you know, it's middle of winter. It's freezing. There's snow everywhere. The river's iced up. Who on earth's going to be jumping into a river in the middle of winter?
And I think it was Daniel Perez that actually told me where de Hinden lost the trail. The tracks went into a lake in a boat launch.
Yeah.
And whatever it was must have swam across the lake.
Yeah.
Who on earth is going to do that in the middle of winter? With a crippled foot.
Yep, absolutely.
So, and you can say the same thing about the Patterson film in this instance. You know, you hear all these stories of, you know, Sasquatch prior to 1967. And let's be honest, most of them were of the male variety.
Mm.
Why would you make a fake of a female Sasquatch? Wouldn't you want it to be a male? And number two, if you were to fake a film, why would you do it in broad daylight? Wouldn't you want to do it in the dark or maybe camera experts and film experts wouldn't notice things?
Yeah. And Bluff Creek, once again, is not even in this day and age, Cameron, Bluff Creek is not an easy place to get to.
No. I've never been there. I'd like to get there.
Hmm.
I know Daniel Perez and then some of the other people from the Bluff Creek Project do amazing work there.
Yeah.
Trying to preserve the area the best they can. I mean, it's in a national forest, so they can't exactly, you know, clear trees out and make it look like the film site like it did in 1967, which is too bad because that's exactly what I would have done if I was a park ranger in 67 that believed in Sasquatch. I'd be like, okay, we need to keep this area the exact same way it is for future generations. But of course, nobody thought like that, right?
Yep.
But yeah, like that's the thing. And I mean, okay, so you could jump to the other side of the fence. Patterson wrote a book in 1966 prior to filming his film. And there is a picture drawing of a female Sasquatch with breasts. So a lot of people who think it's a fake go, oh, look, he drew it. You know, he made this up. He had this idea that's completely untrue.
Hmm.
And you know what? If Patterson did fake this, well, you know what? Good on you, bud, because you fooled the entire world.
Yeah.
Good on you, bud. I round of applause because you fooled me.
Yeah. Well, I know enough about B-movies and monster films at that era, Cameron, to know that there was nobody anywhere in Hollywood or any other part of the world who was able to create any suit that looked anything like that. And I have seen numerous attempts, National Geographic's famous, hilariously bad attempt to fake it about five or 6 years ago. And I've always said, if it's so easy to do, do it. And nobody can. Nobody can. So if you want to convince me it was a fake, then simply repeat it. But I don't want anybody using anything that's available now. You've got to only use what was available in 1967. And if you can come anywhere close to that, I'll give you $1 million, because I don't think anybody can.
No, absolutely not. And even, you know, the main kind of, I guess you could say, suspect back then was John Chambers, who did the Planet of the Apes films, I believe.
Mm.
I think he laughed it off and said, there's no way I could do that.
Yep, yep. Yep. So, well, if you look at Planet of the Apes, you can clearly see that that's Roddy McDowall wearing a mask, you know?
Right, right. So, but, you know, back to the Bosberg thing, I just think, and yes, and I think this is what happened. And keep in mind, all the big names of the Sasquatch research world were down there after this happened. Mm. You had Roger Patterson down there. You had DeGrover Krantz down there. You had Dehinden down there, obviously. I don't know if John Green went down there or not. I could be mistaken. I don't think he did. Could be wrong. You know, so you had the big names of Sasquatch research all down there. And that's because I went into another story about how this, and Peter Byrne was down there. Peter Byrne was down there.
Yeah.
About how this guy apparently had, he said, oh yeah, I got a frozen one, or I shot one or whatever here. And then it became a bidding. I don't know if you ever heard that story. There's one on there on YouTube. Yeah. So anyway, that's kind of funny. But I think if it was a fake, I don't think you'd have all the top guys in Sasquatch research down there.
Yeah.
So so to me, Bosberg is number two. Number three, and I kind of get – I've been on a show, another – have you ever watched Squatchers Lounge podcast with the Reverend Jeff Kelly?
No, I haven't actually.
It's a very good show to watch. I'll send you – I'll email you the link to his channel. I've been on his show a few times. And we made a debate show one time. I'm a very high believer in the Sierra recordings from Ron Moorhead and Al Berry.
Yep, yeah, I've spoke to Ron a couple of times.
Right, and I really think those are real.
Mm.
I don't, again, and I mean, if they aren't, well, good on them. You fooled me. But I just don't know how you could fake something like that in 1972.
Yep.
I just don't. And if they do, well, good on them. They should be making, you know, records or something like that. They should be in the music industry. I just think it's, we're Jeff Kelly in that, he doesn't really believe they're real. He thinks they're fake, and that's fine. He's entitled to his opinion, and everybody else is. But to me, I think they should be highly regarded. Mm. Because when you think about it, there was the famous Jerry Crew tracks in 1958. Then we didn't really have anything till the Patterson film. And then after that, we didn't have anything till Bosberg. Then after that, we didn't really have anything till the Sierra Sounds.
Mm.
Well, then what did we really have after that?
Mm.
There's always, so to me, I think the Sierra Sounds should be, are up there at number three. I do think they're real. If I'm wrong, well, then I'm wrong. But to me, I just don't know how a regular human could make sounds like that at a supposed hunting camp in the Sierra Nevada mountains in 1972.
Yeah.
I don't know how that's possible.
Yeah. I mean, once again as well, Cameron, that's another very remote location. And sound technology in the early 70s, you know, you'd be lugging enormous speakers to an area where you have to dismount your horse to get to. Where Ron and Al went to that site. And it's still treacherous this day and age to get to, because I know it's still visited occasionally. Ron's goes up there infrequently these days, but he does still go back. And it's still really treacherous to get there. So I find it incredibly hard to believe that a group of guys in the early 70s decided to lump a massive sound system into the middle of the Sierra Nevadas to try and create some kind of crazy soundscapes that, you know, we're talking 50 years ago. How on earth are you, you know, it was difficult enough to get yourself there, never mind a sound system.
That's right. I'd like to interview Ron Moorhead, but I've had a little bit difficulty doing that. But I believe his story, and I don't think Al Berry would be someone who would hoax anything like this.
Mm.
I, to my knowledge, I believe he was a newspaper reporter in San Francisco, I believe.
Yeah, and he was deeply skeptical as well. He didn't believe any
of it. Yes, that's right. Exactly.
Till it happens.
So, yeah, exactly. And that's usually how it goes.
Yeah.
But, so I would say those are the three key big evidence. And I would say, as an honorable mention, number four, I would probably put the Skookum body cast.
Mm.
Whether or not I haven't heard too much more about that. I don't know if anything's been proven or not with that. I've kind of lost track of it, but
Well, I think the last thing I want to touch on, Cameron, before I let you go back to the early fall snow that's coming your way, is
we're getting big flakes now. The flakes have gotten bigger since we started the show. So,
well, we'd best get cracking then, my friend. And that is you beginning work on your first book. So, what can you tell us about this and what your plans are for the release of it and what you're looking to cover in it?
Right. So basically, this all kind of started randomly. I was listening to another Sasquatch podcast with Thomas Steinberg on, and something just clicked in my head going, gee, maybe I should write a book or write something down about, you know, what you've found or what you've done over the years. So it's just something I've been working on for a while. It starts, you know, as far back as when this started in 1997 in the fall, all the way up to now, kind of how I met people along the way, my thoughts on the Sasquatch. I go a little bit into the other supposed creatures of the Sasquatch. That was the hardest kind of, I guess you could say, chapter to write. Because like I say, I mostly focus on just the Sasquatch. I don't really focus on the Abominable Snowman. I don't focus on the Yowie. I just stay strictly home, Canada, Sasquatch, Alberta, BC, because there's a great piece of advice from Rene de Hinden. You know, you could run over Hell's Half Bloody Acre and, you know, chasing all these reports and everything, when really it's easier to just stick closer to home. Yeah. It's like a hunter who watches the deer, who knows where they're going to be. So he can say, you know, come November, whatever, blah, 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 I go in the woods and pop off a deer. Because he knows where they are, instead of running all over the country, all over wherever, you know. So it's really good advice. So that chapter was the hardest to write because I didn't really, I mean, yeah, I know what the Abominable Snowman is and that, but since I really restarted, I've been just mostly focusing on local stuff, right? I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't drive, so I don't have, I can't get to the United States or get a book of plane ticket to China or wherever to go to the Himalayas. So
yeah,
that was a hard chapter to write. And then it gets into how I kind of became a guest on Jeff Kelly's show. I believe the title of the chapter is called Cancer and Sasquatch. Because at the time I was going through cancer and I had to sit there and take my chemo treatment and I wanted something to watch or listen to because it, you know, took about 3-4 hours.
Yeah.
So I got watching Jeff Kelly's show and then, you know, I would watch it and tune in every week and then one thing led to another and I got on to the show and I'll send you my playlist of all the shows I've been on and you can watch them and you can either have a good laugh or get some good information, however way you want to determine it.
So, well, thank you.
And he's really done a lot for me as, you know, not necessarily, you know, promoting, getting my name out there and saying, you know, here's a legit guy that's younger and, you know, wants to get into this. And when I got my name published in the newsletter by Daniel, that was huge. I mean, I'm going to frame that. Like, I mean, that was,
yeah,
you know,
here's
something that gets mailed around the world to show people that I'm a very old school researcher. I, you know, I'm not into the woo. I'm not into putting UFOs with Sasquatch. I'm, you know, like Rene de Hinden says, I'm into Sasquatch in the bush on the ground.
Yeah.
I'm not think it has anything to do with aliens. I don't think it has anything to do with any of that. So that I go into that more in my book. I'm going to work on, it's just a rough copy right now. I hope to do more work on it over the winter. I got sidetracked a little bit because of real life events, you know, that happens.
Yep.
So hopefully over the winter I can, you know, make it look more pretty and, you know, get more pages added to it. Cause you know, I talked to Doug Hijack about it and he, you know, if he says, if it gets to this point, yeah, I could probably publish it for you. So that would be great.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just something cool. I never, ever thought in my life I would ever write a book. I mean, I'm not an author. I'm more used to being on YouTube shows and podcasts because my dad says I had the perfect face for radio. So it's interesting. I did it and I sent you, I don't know if you have a chance to skim through it or what your thoughts are. I mean, if whatever you did see, or I hope you liked it at least. Some,
yeah.
Whatever you saw.
Yeah, certainly plenty of food for thought there. And I wish you the very best of luck with it. I look forward to the completed work. It certainly seems a very intriguing collection. So I look forward to it, Cameron, and I wish you the very best of luck with it. I hope you get it finished as soon as you can.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Well, fantastic. So, Cameron, where can everybody keep up to date with your work and follow you on your travels and on the hunt for Sasquatch?
Well, I do have a Facebook group, but I've personally deactivated my own personal account. But the page is still up and running. Just type in Cameron Young Sasquatch Research Group. I may have a bunch of invites that I have to check on to get people accepted into there. But for people that are listening, whether it be, you know, Canada or wherever, if you have a sighting, if you have some information regarding the Sasquatch, the best way to reach me is by email. And that's all lowercase letters, cam.young82@gmail.com. That's cam.young82@gmail.com. And that's the best way to talk to me Sasquatch wise, because like I said, I don't have my personal Facebook up and running, so I'm not really on my page as much. I'm waiting. I'd like to get a website done so I can just put all my research stuff on there instead of having to use Facebook. So but yeah, if anybody wants to, you know, if you're listening in Alberta or Canada or wherever and you have a Sasquatch sighting, or if you need questions answered, the best way to reach me is that email address.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put links to both in the show notes, Cameron.
Wonderful.
If anybody wants to drop a line, then I suggest they just check the show notes and they'll be able to follow you up either on Facebook or via email.
That's correct.
I would just like to say thank you so much for an enlightening and enjoyable conversation. It's been a pleasure to finally speak to you, and I wish you the very best of luck, and hopefully we will speak again sometime.
For sure. So I'm definitely got the mindset of Renee DeHinden. I will keep on searching till I find the damn thing. That's my goal.
And I wish you the best of luck in it, Cameron.
Thank you very much.
Casino. American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right Rug.